Welcome to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast, presented by Cooper Tires. My guest this episode, the great Swede, my pal Stefan Johansson. So this is actually part two of the My Racing Life and Career series that we have done with Steph. I do apologize for the long wait for this. We actually captured it in November of 2017. This is part of a very memorable trip for me down to Southern California. First day I spent with Steph in his art studio, which is just a lovely thing, where Steph does genuine art. It isn't just a studio that he's in. He is an artist. He also keeps a lot of his racing memorabilia there, photographs, helmets, and otherwise. It's the ultimate artist's man cave, almost. It sits high above a kind of collective work studio below, and is also directly behind a church. So there's lots of great stuff going on there. It's a bigger space, and I love it. Can't wait to go back and spend some more time with Steph. We did capture a part three in our series a little bit earlier this year at Sebring, so I will try to get that out here in the coming months. And then the second part of my trip, well, actually, while there, about 2 miles away, popped around and saw my friend Oriol Servia in his brand new Po King restaurant in Santa Monica. And then the next day, I went and had lunch before flying home with my friend Dan Gurney, which that was genuinely the most memorable part because it was the last time we saw each other. So I think I mentioned that before, that, said a bit of a farewell there, not knowing that we would lose him in January. Regardless, very memorable trip. Started off with this time with Steph and covered his 1984 through 1987 Formula One career, the part one of the My Racing Life and Career series with Steph. It was really his origins coming up through the junior formula and his intro to Formula One, culminating with the end of the conversation, 1983, when he was the not only race driver, but kind of test dummy as well for Honda's new twin-turbo Formula One V6 engine with the Spirit team. So here we jump into 1984. He definitely has a bit of a collision with Ayrton Senna, as the Tolman team that Senna was driving for and Steph was driving for a little bit. Interesting juxtaposition of their two careers. 1985, Steph signs for Scuderia Ferrari, and his tale of meeting Mr. Ferrari, what the interaction was like there, signing his contract, that two-year contract, fascinating. We actually closed, so this is a podcast dedicated to a relatively short stint in Steph's career, but I would say his most memorable Formula One times, and that's closing in 1987 when he joined the McLaren team as teammate to three-time Formula One world champion Alain Prost. So it's the usual Steph, lots of character, lots of fun, great stories, and I hope you enjoy this. And I'm going to try and get part three out here soon. We need to capture a part four and five because he has done so much in his life. And he is by all means, at least for me, the most interesting man in the world. So hopefully there'll be some beer companies throwing commercial money his way. You know, you can get every episode of the Marshall Pruitt Podcast on iTunes, also on Podbean, on our Marshall Pruitt Podcast Facebook page, and even Google Play Music as well. All right, off we go with Stefan Johansson, part two. So Steph, when we sat down at Long Beach, we're starting to close on your 83 season, this kind of crazy developmental season with Honda coming into Formula One, with the minnows at the Spirit team. Told some great stories about testing at Willow Springs, of all places, and some of the Japanese engineers being fond of winding up the boost just to see what would happen. Tell me about how this kind of crazy 83 intro to the world of Formula One turbos ended for you, and what the prospects were going into 84, because it wasn't the easiest transition, it looked like.
No, well, it didn't end very well for either myself or the Spirit team, as it were, because Honda pulled the plug on their program, which effectively meant that, you know, my drive was also gone because, you know, they went to Williams and they already had their drivers lined up. And I think they had Keke and Lafitte that year. So it was, you know, little bit of a surprise for everybody, I think, and obviously left left all of us in a kind of a funk, you know, as far as like what do we do now, you know, for 84. In my case, Honda helped me, you know, arrange a Formula 2 drive in Japan, which was obviously, you know, not the ideal scenario by any means, you know, to take a step out of Formula sure. 1 and go and race F2 in Japan. But it was, at the time, it was really the only option I had, you know, because there was no seats available in Formula 1, obviously, and I wasn't really in that position anyway to, you know, to with the results we had with the Honda was obviously, you know, hard to impress anyone because the car rarely lasted a whole distance anyway.
It was fun while it lasted.
Well, we had good qualifying. I mean, we had some pretty strong qualifying results and stuff. But so anyway, so that's what I did. I decided to do that. But in parallel, I also had the drive with Joost in Group C still.
Started a great
relationship. The Porsche program, yeah. So I mean, that carried on from the year before. You know, I did the Marlboro car in 83, obviously, the full season, and we won the European Championship, myself and Bob Wallach. And
I know this, it's a little bit of a diversion from F1, and we'll probably save your sports car career for a separate podcast, but I did want to stop quickly, though, in that 83 season. Some of the stories you tell of that Porsche and the power that it had, the low drag, low downforce at Le Mans and such. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're stepping out of a Honda-powered Formula One car with a zillion horsepower, but almost undrivable because of the lack of, you know, tuning to it, what was it like stepping into what was then, you know, the world's most cutting-edge prototype? Was that a easy transition going back and forth for you? Did you enjoy one more than the other?
Well, I mean, I enjoyed both, of course. I mean, they were quite different back then, you know, because the Group C cars had massive downforce back then with full tunnels and everything. So they were, you know, and they had a lot of horsepower too, you know, so they were real beasts to drive. Obviously a lot heavier than the Formula One car, but they were extremely exciting cars to drive as well. I mean, all the cars back then were exciting to drive because it was big horsepower, very little downforce in general terms, except the prototypes. And, you know, mostly just big tire grip, you know, so, but grip level overall was obviously much, much lower than it is today. So they were exciting, you know, and there was no electronics, so everything was very crude and rudimentary, you know, and a lot more feel, I guess, was required from the driver because in some way that, you know, the driver was the software, you know.
Yeah.
And that, you know, so your sensitivity on the throttle foot was really critical, you know, in terms of traction and car control in general, really.
Were you able to appreciate at that time, at this young stage in your career, that you were, granted, I realize this wasn't Ferrari or McLaren in Formula One, but you were at least working in two series where, I mean, we at least today look back and say golden eras, just amazing golden eras. Were you able to appreciate that at the time, or you?
No, because that's what it was, you know. I mean, you don't realize at the time, you just you know, you do it, you know, this, I mean, you strive to get to the top of whatever, you know, the tree is, but and those two categories were, of course, but I mean, you had nothing to reflect on, so you know, there was just, that's what the cars were at the time, you know, and that was it, basically. I mean, it's only history only allows you to understand that, you know, when you see how things have progressed and how things are progressing.
So you go from getting your first kind of finger hold on Formula One to that going away. You have this side opportunity, which is stepping back. You've already proven yourself in Formula 2, but that's what's made available. Martin Brundle breaks his ankle, hurts his feet at Dallas, the 84 Dallas Grand Prix. How does the call come, or how does the interaction come between you and Ken Tyrrell to open that door?
Well, I still went to as many F1 races as I could, you know, even just because, you know, I just...
It's a smart thing to do.
You know, you got to be on top of people's mind, you know. And I hadn't, certainly hadn't given up on the Formula One dream at any point, you know. In fact, I was called up to do that race at Sebring, you know, with 12 Hours, which we won in the Yost and the Moby Dick car in 84. Which was another crazy story, but we can leave that for later on.
That's the sports car podcast.
And it was the same weekend as the first Grand Prix of the season in Brazil. And I remember, you know, having maybe done one of the best drives of my whole career, in fact. You know, I felt nothing but kind of sadness that I wasn't in Brazil, you know, for the Formula One race. And it was only later on that I could really appreciate what a great day I'd had at Sebring, you know. But at the time, I was just kind of angry and a little bit bitter and just couldn't really enjoy the moment, you know, of winning the Sebring race, because the only thing that was on my mind was Formula One, you know. So I went to a lot of the races before that, and just to kind of talk to people and just being in the scene, you know. And so when the call came, you know, or when the opportunity came, then I'm sure it had at least a part of it, the fact that I've, you know, been around, and, you know, when they think of drivers to call, then, you know, the fact that I've been there in the paddock every race almost, walking around like a spare prick, you know, but that's what you got to do, you know. So
so you go from this crazy extreme turbo Honda spirit to, I believe, the only naturally aspirated car left in F1 at that time.
Yeah.
You know, a very analog car with a Cosworth DFY or whatever is in the back of it.
Yeah.
Obviously, there was some legality questions at the time with the Tyrrell team. They were using the water ballast tanks. End of the season, all the results were wiped away as if they never existed.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
What was it like stepping into that car? Because I have to imagine, it looked like it was a blast to drive. It wasn't as fast, but...
Yeah, I mean, it's a very lively car. A light, small, I mean, it's tiny. Everything was so small on the car, yeah.
It looked like a dance.
I mean, there's no car. I mean, like, God forbid if you had an accident, because there was nothing around you to support you whatsoever. Yeah. Head sticking out a foot out of the cockpit, you know. So it was it was like a little go-kart almost in the car, but it took a little bit getting used to, because it was just so lively and just virtually no car straddles. So the steering was extremely reactive and light on the car. And because that's just what they evolved to, I guess, you know, with you know, over a period of time with his chassis. But it, you know, it was good, and it was an opportunity that I grabbed it with both hands, you know, and tried to do the best I can. And, you know, and in fact, it worked out really well, because I had qualified Beloff, which was then hailed as the sort of next messiah, you know.
Absolutely.
In my first race with him at Brands Hatch. And I think, four races I did, I think I did it in all of them, and I certainly outraced him. So, you know, it all worked well, and I think it kind of got the attention of Ferrari as well at the same time a little bit, you know. And then, of course, the results were what they were, you know. But my only focus was to beat Beloff, you know, because I had a good yardstick, you know. Everybody was kind of paying attention to him already.
But it also kind of leaves you in a situation with the lack of a turbo where... you know that you can more or less win every corner, but any kind of long straight, you're just waiting to get, you know, rocked.
Oh, completely, yeah. I mean, but the best, the most fun, and the best, by far the best run I had was in Austria, which, you know, it was like a pure horsepower circuit. But the car was, because I love, and I still do, but I mean, I love fast corners, you know, when you're just balancing the car on the limit the whole time, you know, entry to exit. And I think I was actually like 2 seconds quicker than Beloff in qualifying or something. So, yeah, so it was. I mean, I just loved it, you know. But we were slow. I mean, overall, we were bog slow, of course, you know.
You won 18th place, like never
but
before.
It was still, you know, just, and that's, I think that might have been one of those sort of moments where you realize that, you know, you can't win every battle to win the war. But it was, you know, it just made me realize that you got to enjoy the moment. You know, you just got to enjoy the situation you're in, because you can't always have the best equipment, you can't always be in a position to win, but you can still do the best you can and feel great about it when you're done, you know. And that was just a greatest feeling, you know, because you're absolutely on the limit and you're barely scraping into 26th place or whatever it was at the time. But it was, I knew that I drove that car to the absolute maximum of its performance, you know, and it was good enough for me, you know, because, and the fact that I was more than 2 seconds quicker than my teammate, who everybody, you know, and still to this day hailed us to sort of next Ayrton Senna almost, you know, so it was good, you know.
So looking at your early Formula One career, opportunism definitely stands out, and you mentioning about, you know, being the extra guy in the paddock all the time, that's something that I and you and others I know preach to young drivers. Hey, if this is what you want to be, they've got to see you if you want an opportunity, and it happens from time to time.
Yeah.
Senna in 84 announces premature early that he's leaving Tolman to go to Lotus. Tolman, as a result, decides to stand him down, and you get the call to step into that Hart-powered chassis and impressed immediately. Tell me about how that came about, because again, I just,
well,
love
it wasn't
the
actually from
there.
Senna stepping, it was from Johnny Cecotto getting injured.
I apologize.
Yeah, so that's how I got to drive for the rest of the year, when he got his injury, you know.
Apologies.
And then they stepped Senna down like 2 days before the Monza race, and then they had actually Pierluigi Martini in his place for that one race. But yeah, same thing, you know. I mean, so then Brundle came back to Tyrrell, and then it just so happened that Cecotto then got injured almost simultaneously. And I had already had very good relations with the Tolman guys because I drove for them in F2. And Chris Whitty, who was, you know, one of my sort of people who helped me very much early on in my career, you know, he was sort of the commercial director for Tolman at the time, and worked hard on Alex Hawkridge, you know, to make sure that, you know, I was in the frame there. And I knew Alex very well, obviously, from the F2 days too, you know, and we had some good races there, you know, with that car. So it kind of became almost immediately when then the call came, you know, to jump in there.
So. Fourth place in Italy.
Yeah.
Monza, on your debut with them. I mean, you'd already shown a hell of a lot of potential, but you didn't necessarily have the finishing result to hold up in the newspaper to say, see, I've told you.
And I blew the start completely, you know, and I got off the line last, I think, you know, so it was, I had to drive through the entire field, basically, to get the fourth. But yeah, the car was really good, really good. The engine was quite impressive for, you know, for such a small operation.
Brian Hart, you got
Yeah, I
love
mean, Brian was, he was great. I mean, I love Brian. You know, we worked on so many different, from Formula 2, you know, with the F2 engine, and then F1, and then after Tolman with the DFVs, because he prepared those as well, you know, and yeah, he was a great guy.
But what did you find yourself, granted, having to kind of start over again in charge from the back, but was there any point where you were having any realization, not necessarily during the race, but, you know, being so close to a podium, first race out with a team that was not a front-running team? I mean, a lot of potential. Was that a moment for you in F1 where you said, okay, you know, if there was any doubt before from anyone, I'm showing you that I deserve an opportunity with a real, real program?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, you know, I mean, it's kind of weird because, you know, look, I mean, in my mind, and that's kind of how you have to be, I think. I was already better than all the rest of them.
Of course.
I mean, that, you know, so for me, it was just like, I was just doing my job, you know, and I had zero regard for any of them because that's how you have to kind of convince yourself that you are, you know. I mean, I think it's just the psychology of how you have to be, you know. And everybody's like that. I mean, everybody's got a big ego, you know. If you want to make it big in any sport, I think, you know, you don't have to show it, but that's at least how I was thinking, you know. So So when I passed all these guys, it was just, you know, it wasn't like, oh, yeah, I just passed, you know, whoever, you know, whatever.
Sure, sure.
For me, it was just the process, you know, of eliminating one opponent after the other, you know, and working away at it, basically.
Putting them in their place.
Yeah, well, kind of, I suppose, yeah, in a way, yeah.
So you demonstrate, again, clearly to the paddock that this kid is on a path to something bigger and better. How does communication start with Ferrari for 85? Because I know that, there was obviously, it wasn't necessarily an immediate thing, but in terms of starting the season, but how did those conversations start? Are you reaching out to them? Are they reaching out to you?
They reached out to me, in fact, after the last race at Portugal, when Senna was third and I was running fourth, fighting with Nicky the whole race. It was only when I got a puncture, you know, he eventually got by me. Otherwise, I mean, he would have lost the championship, in fact, if he couldn't get by me. And he was like behind me nearly the whole race. Well, till about two-thirds distance or something, when I had a slow puncture. But anyway, and I guess Enzo was watching the race at Mr. Ferrari, and then Marco Piccinini contacted me shortly after that. And so we had some conversations, you know, more about testing in preparation for something further down the road, maybe.
Yeah.
So we had this dialogue going for a while, and then, of course, you know, then. But I already had a contract with Tolman then. I'd already done a contract for 85 with them.
No.
Because they did, when we did the deal, they had an option for 85, which they then took up almost immediately when the season was over. So I had actually a two-year contract with them, 85 and 86. But then, I don't know if you remember, there was all this political stuff going on with the tires.
Exactly.
And they, in fact, didn't have any tires for the Brazilian Grand Prix. So there I was again, without a drive, went out there on a whim, just kind of hanging around the paddock, and Tyrrell decided to pull Beloff out of the car because they had some disagreement over something. So, of course, I had my kit in the bag just in case. But, I mean, this was literally like, I mean, I'm not exaggerating, 9 o'clock in the morning on Friday.
Yeah.
Ken called, have you got your kit with you? I said, sure. Or get in the car, then he goes, you know, so literally had an hour before first practice.
What was Tyrrell like to deal with? Because I've read so many things about him. It just seemed like a real kind of, you know, old school but warm character.
He was fantastic. I mean, I have nothing but good things to say. I mean, for young drivers, he's probably the best team owner you could drive for, because he had so much knowledge and experience and just little tricks to teach you, you know. I think it was tougher for established drivers that came into the team to be lectured and told what to do all the time. But for a young and inexperienced guy like me, it was fantastic, you know. Yeah.
So.
And he was funnier than, I mean,
yeah.
Going out to dinner at night and stuff, it was great. I mean, he was just a wonderful guy, you know, and Nora, his wife, and everybody as well, you know. So, yeah, it was a good, totally different scene, of course, then. It was like just a family kind of thing, you know, but it was great.
So had you known you were doing the season, 85 season, with Tolman, the tires in place and everything, I'm sure you would have been doing some testing leading up to the year?
Yeah, so we did quite a lot of testing, in fact. We did all the testing in Brazil with a car.
Okay.
And I mean, I knew from, although we had a lot of engine problems at the time, the engine would never really run properly, but I could tell the car was amazing. The Tolman.
Wow.
It was, I mean, Rory Byrne.
Yeah, I know.
Is, in my mind, still the best. I mean, maybe, you know, with Adrian Newey, of course, but I mean, he's just a fantastic designer.
A wonderful car.
Every single car that I drove of his, I mean, they got this harmony in the car that you just don't feel in any other car. It's just this quietness and the suspension and everything, you know, it's just, which allows you to feel the car in a much better way, you know. Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, that car was incredible. So, you know, in a way, of course, you got the opportunity with Ferrari later on, but had that car run from the beginning, it would have been even better, because the car was so good, and I'm sure we would have done incredibly well with that car, you know, in the season, and then that would have probably led to something even more interesting, maybe, you know.
So you get the call or you get the ask to drive the old battle axe with on an hour's notice to start the season.
Yeah.
You've obviously been doing some testing, so you know you've got your fitness and whatnot. You know your neck's not going to fall off after five laps and thing. But in one way, I want to ask, how do you do that with essentially no notice? But I also know that a young driver like yourself would say, I get a full hour? Great. You know, I mean, I don't care. Give me 2 minutes notice as long as I have time to get dressed.
My whole career was like that, you know, until then and many times after that as well. I mean, you know, it was kind of like thrown in the deep end, you know, and just sort of get on with it, you know, and you just deal with it and you know, to figure it out. You know, that's what you got to do, basically.
So there's the Tolman issue going on. Can't get tires. You've got this one-off opportunity that comes your way with Tyrrell. There's some interesting things going on with Ferrari as well that all of a sudden, if you'd been talking about testing in the past, this another opportunity comes up. How does that develop? Or is this something where you're, you know, talking to Mr. Ferrari and Maranello over this? You know, how does that come about?
No, I was contacted almost immediately after Brazil, in fact, like I think the next day or two, as soon as I got back to England, because I lived in London at the time, I got a call from Marco Piccinini saying that, you know, or maybe it was less than a week before the Portuguese Grand Prix, which was the next one.
Yeah.
And so it all happened very quickly, you know. He flew in to London. We met at the Savoy, where he was staying.
Nice.
And literally said, you know, we want you to drive, you know, and we just want to meet Mr. Ferrari first. But, I mean, this is the deal. This is the terms. Yada, yada, yada.
And again, I won't ask money, but were the terms fair? Or was it you're a young driver and we know you're giving you all an opportunity?
More or less, yeah. I'm a young
driver. We won't charge you too much.
No. But I mean, Ferrari would never do that. But it wasn't, you know, but the money back then wasn't staggering anyway. But it was
Ferrari.
It was, you know, and frankly, had they told me to drive for, you know, luncheon vouchers, I probably would have done that too, you know, as it were, because I mean, it's every driver's dream to drive for Ferrari, of course, you know, and maybe even more so then than it is now, you know, because it was Enzo Ferrari who chose you to be his driver, you know. So, yeah, so then, you know, we did that, and then I had to obviously call Alex Hawkridge and give him, you know, the news and say, well, you know, this is the deal. I mean, I've been offered the Ferrari drive, you know, and they still didn't know what they were doing. They still didn't have tires, and he said, well, I can't hold you back, obviously, you know, if you get this opportunity, you've got to let you go, you know, and so, you know, he was very kind, you know, and released me from their contract. And then I flew down to Maranello on, I think it was Tuesday night.
Because what they had sacked, wouldn't they? They sacked Arnoux, I think.
Yeah,
after the first race.
Yeah. So I flew down there, landed in Bologna in the afternoon, got picked up by Pier Paolo Gardella, the little assistant to Marco. Drove to the old factory in Modena, not the Maranello. Okay. Meet there secretly in Mr. Ferrari's old office there. I mean, completely, it was nothing. It was just empty, basically.
Was it like? I mean, I've seen photos. It's almost a mythical thing.
Surreal. Like everything with Ferrari, it's like a Fellini movie. Everything, you know. I don't know why, but.
So you walk into this.
Yeah, so we walk through this corridor, you know, in the old. This is the old factory, just some old cars with blankets on top of them and stuff, you know, no lights, just the sunlight coming through the side. It was like, you know, and there's photographs of Stirling Moss, Fangio, Farini, you know, all the heroes, you know, all black and white, and like you get goosebumps, you know, just thinking about it. And then we walk into Ferrari's office, and he's sitting in the back there, you know, and all you can see is kind of the silhouette, you know, and the nose and the whole nine yards, you know. And then sat down, and, you know, Piero Ferrari's there, and Marco Piccinini, and then Mr. Ferrari, of course. And they're talking back and forth a little bit, you know, and then he sort of asked me, are you hungry? But Marco then had to translate, you know. And I've been flying from London, I was starving, but I kind of knew that's not what he meant, you know. So I said, I've never been more hungry in my life, you know, and he laughed, and I said, okay, you're in.
Wow. And so him, his famous purple pen, in which he signed everything. I mean, how, I know that obviously you're wanting to get this done, go drive, go test. Was there any sense of just, did you take a moment just for satisfaction of like, wow, this is a big step for me. This means something.
Not at the time. And it was just like so surreal, the whole thing, and happened so fast, you know. I mean, literally, it was, you know, the next, I think I did like 5 laps at Fiorano the next day, just to, you know, with Michele's seat, which I ended up having for the race in Portugal as well. So, I mean, I had like literally blood pouring out of my shoulders at the end of the race because it was so uncomfortable, the seat, you know. Yeah, no time to do a seat fitting or anything, you know, so.
So that 85 Ferrari 156, I have always thought it's one of the most beautiful Ferraris of that era.
Yeah, definitely.
Looked amazing. Motor was very impressive as well. What was it like getting back into a turbo car? And also, what was it like working now with a proper factory, not a garagiste who made a chassis and a motor supplied by some book? What was it like being a factory driver for Formula One, where you can go and talk to the men making the engines, doing everything else? What was it like coming into that? I have to imagine, knowing your tinkering ways, you must have loved that.
Yeah, I mean, it was obviously a big step, you know, in so many different ways, you know, to do that, and then dealing with all the, just everything with the, being in a big team like that, and then Ferrari on top of it, you know, with Italian media and all the other, you know, stuff that went on. So it was, I mean, everything just, it was like a blur almost, the whole, you know, first early part of it, you know. But, I mean, the races went well, obviously, you know. I mean, you know, almost right away. I mean, I was kind of, you know, unlucky. I know I could have won three races on the trot day, you know, starting in Montreal. Well, Imola, really. I mean, the second race I should have won. We ran out of fuel. And I'm sure, had, you know, things would have changed dramatically. You know, just that first one is always the hard one. And the dynamic in the team and everything else, you know. But like always with big teams, there's an enormous amount of politics, you know. So, especially with Ferrari, and especially at that time, you know. So,
tell me a little bit about the car itself. Because this is an era in F1, 1985, 83 and 84, at least from everything that I've read, 83, 84 painted as pretty much the horsepower peak. Getting into 85, it's still continuing. We get to 86, 7, 8. That's where the FIA start trying to pull power back. But what is it like? I mean, we have the year, you're part of one of the most iconic photos ever of you belching, you know, ungodly amounts of flame, in Monaco in this car.
Yeah.
Tell me about driving this Ferrari F-156 at Monaco, for example. What kind of power is under your right foot, and what kind of insanity is coming through your visor?
Yeah, I mean, it was crazy, really, because, you know, there was no traction control, none of that, you know, at the time. And I mean, I think we had, I don't know what power we had in Monaco, but I know at Monza we had 1,500 horsepower, maybe even more, because I don't think the dyno could handle, you know, so they weren't really sure what it was, but it was a lot of power. And I mean, in qualifying, you just literally just blanked off the wastegate, and whatever you got, that's what you got, you know. And I remember it was, I mean, every single gear was just wheel spin, you know. So I mean, going up the hill, the thing was just, you couldn't pick the gears quick enough. You just kind of had to keep your foot in it and just let it, you know, just go, basically, because if you lift and try to correct, you know, and the car was just sliding back and forth, if it suddenly grabbed and gripped, you would just, it'll just shoot you into the wall, you know. So you just kept it trajecting up the hill, you know, until you got to the top and had to jump on the brakes, you know. But it was it's like the qualifying lap was just a big blur, you know. We're just holding on and trying to make it point in a straight line, basically.
How mentally exhausting was that? Because if we're talking folks racing today, obviously there are a lot of race cars that go quickly, but when you have minimal weight, obscene power, and again, if we're looking at a Monaco or some other place where you're having to do a lot of fast movements, I mean, there has come a point where the brain's processing power, your eyes, your hand-eye coordination, I'm not saying you're at that limit, but I have to imagine you're getting close to the physical ability to extract the maximum.
To, you did have to just hold on to it, you know, and do just, like I said, I mean, normally you're able to process everything pretty well, you know, and everything is, even though it happens, it kind of feels like it's in slow motion mostly, because, you know, so you still have time to
control everything. I don't know how the brain does that, but it's amazing when it does that.
Yeah, yeah. And that's when you know you're on top of it, you know, when you feel like you're sort of walking on the pavement, really. You know, it's not an effort, really. You just, everything is just flowing and it's processing everything in a very kind of quiet way. But, that, you know, you don't want to feel like your car's driving you. You know, you want to feel like you're driving the car. And, of course, in a situation like that, it was definitely creeping into the territory where the car was driving you, you know, more than the other way around. But I think everybody had the same. I mean, it was just, you know, with that amount of horsepower, you know.
So this 85 season, you grab your first podiums, your first two podiums of Canada and Detroit back-to-back, I believe.
Yeah.
We've already kind of picked up that you weren't a big sense of accomplishment guy at the time. But was there any, like, cool, I'm spraying champagne, aha, this is the place I've known I should be, and here I am?
Well, I mean, yeah, but I was disappointed both races, because the Montreal, I had team orders, you know, to stay behind Mikhail. Otherwise, I would have for 100% won the race. I mean, I was way faster, you know, so I was just backing off basically when I caught him, you know, by a second a lap, and then I just had to sit there and wait, basically. Which at the time, you know, was my third race with the team. You feel, oh, well, there'd be plenty more opportunities, you know, that whatever. He was already established in the team, and I didn't want to rock the boat and whatever. But as it were, you know, I mean, I think in retrospect, you maybe just should obviously go for every win you can, you know. And then Detroit, the brake rotor blew up with a lap to go when, you know, same thing. Keke had huge problems with the cooling, and he really couldn't have put up a defense, you know. So again, had no brakes basically the last two laps. I just had to crawl around to even make it around the corners. You know, otherwise it would have been an easy win there as well. And Nürburgring the same later in the year. So I think I could have won four races pretty comfortably that year, as it were. But you know, if of course, you know, it's always the ifs and the buts and all the rest of it, you know. But
so coming out of 85. Granted, I'd followed Formula One for a number of years by then, but this is really 83, 4, 5 is where I was really starting to pay, you know, a lot more attention. I remember you coming out of 85, didn't have that win that you wanted, and again, you should have had on multiple occasions, but there was a definite feeling of, all right, you know, there is a definite badass that's been established here.
Mm-hmm.
You step out of this beautiful, gorgeous 85 chassis into one of the ugliest dog dick machines I've ever seen, the Ferrari F186. As an artist, I'm guessing when you saw the wraps come off of it, you said, fuck me, seriously?
Yeah, I'll never forget it, actually, the day, because Mikhail and I, we both came down, you know, they asked us to come down to the factory to see the new car and everything. And we'd never even, I mean, back then, we hadn't even seen, like, any drawings or anything of the car, you know. It's just, everybody was just working away at it. And we, you know, they took us into the room there, and we both looked at each other, and like, oh, my God, this is going to be a long season.
And it looked like they carved out a whale or something.
We're both like, what the fuck have they been doing? And it certainly turned out to be that way. I mean, it was a tough car.
I mean, it was just more towards the end of the year, but how's this? You're still able to get a number of podiums that year, and I'm sure you know all your career stats, but this is one that I looked up and I just found it's very telling. When you had, I believe, 79, 80 Formula One starts or so, you had 12 podiums. I mean, you look at those numbers.
Yeah.
And you go, well, and you also factor in that of those 79 or 80, we're talking the fucking Spirit. We're talking you're the only guy driving the non-turbo, you know, in a year of turbos. You've got this 86 car that was going nowhere quickly. There were some later in your career we'll get to. But, you know, if there was a chance, you know, you were headed towards the podium, how much effort did it take to do that in 86? Because that car never looked like it was going to try and help you to get there.
Well, so no, I mean, I kind of had to change my whole attitude to, again, obviously the focus, if you can't win, at least you got to beat your teammate, you know. Mm. So my focus was always on race setup. You know, I didn't really even bother with qualifying because I knew that, you know, if you can get the race set up as good as you can, you can always make something happen, you know, just by trying to be a bit clever on strategy and, you know, tire choice and things like that. So I'd put a lot of emphasis on that all the time. And I always had a good dialogue with the Goodyear guys at the time, you know, and because I figured, you know, I mean, like, same as now, and, you know, tires, you know, tires, engine, chassis, I mean, they're all equally important at the end of the day, you know, to get the results. So I put a lot of emphasis on the tires and making sure that I could do full race distance without having to stop, you know, and try to use as soft a compound as I could, because we had three compounds to choose from each time.
And this is an era which I should have mentioned, although refueling has been common for, you know, two decades now or however long, that was not a part of the program then. So you did absolutely have to, you know, other than stops for tires, you know, you had to make make a car work from loaded with petrol to absolutely empty.
Yeah, so what I did pretty much every weekend, we kind of came up with this strategy to take the C's, which were the softer ones, and give them a heat cycle every day. So we did a short run on Friday and let them sit overnight, did like a 3-lap run or something, you know, and then the same thing on Saturday, let them sit, and that became the race set. Because
nice.
They just cured a little bit. Just enough to, because we had, back then it was always a problem with blistering, and it most of the time it worked. And in fact, I would have won the Mexican Grand Prix had we not had a slow puncture. So I had to start with a fresh set on the left front or the right front, I can't remember, but anyway, that ended up blistering, so Berger ended up winning, otherwise I would have won that race as well, for sure. But anyway, so the focus was always on trying to get the best possible job done, and, you know, really just ignore qualifying and just focus on a really good race setup, you know, that, and it worked most of the time, because I certainly outraced Michele pretty comfortably that year, you know.
So you get to the end of 86, and where do things go, discussions contractually with Ferrari, because obviously you drove for McLaren the following year, but I mean, where in 86 do talks about either continuing or not, I mean, where does that enter the conversation?
Well, it started sort of, you know, frustration level was pretty high at that point, you know, and McLaren was the sort of the winning team, the dominant team at the time, you know. And then Ron, I knew Ron quite well from Formula 3, you know, won the Formula 3 championship in 1980 with Project 4. And I had really good relationships with a lot of people at McLaren from the Project 4 days, and just, you know, knowing a lot of the engineers and designers there and everything from before, you know, Alan Jenkins and Steve Nichols and all those guys, you know.
One thing that again, we see this in hindsight, and it's also something that I'm sure you coach your young driver clients to do, but you're a guy who's always maintained relationships. Mm-hmm. A, you know everybody, but most of all, you don't just know them, but you actually cultivate and maintain relationships, not from to use people, but just, you know, that's always been, I think, one of the keys to your career being so diverse, but also so long. Mm. You're not someone, if something goes wrong and you're out of a drive, you're sitting there wondering what to do and who to call. No, you have 20 people you can call who are invested in what you're doing. So with things at Ferrari being not as pleasant as you would want by the end of 86, do you ring Ron? Does he ring you? I mean, that team at the time, champion, Prost.
Well, we knew each other anyway. In fact, we still went on, I mean, I remember in 86 after Montreal, I think it was, we actually went on vacation together for a few days, because in between two races, I think between Detroit and Montreal or something. So we were hanging out just kind of socially, you know, and so it kind of just kind of evolved organically almost, you know. And then with Keke, I think he announced his retirement around the same time. So we had conversations going on quite early on, you know, and, you know, then, of course, Ron, at the same time, was trying hard to get Senna, but that didn't work out. So it took a while to get to seal the deal. But, you know, I figured at the time it was the best opportunity for me, although I knew it could only mean 1 year, possibly, you know, if Senna was in the pipeline, which of course he was. So that's what ended up happening anyway.
So you had handled your teammates pretty much everywhere up to this point fairly easily. What did you find in working with your new teammate, reigning world champion Alan Prost? Was he welcoming to you? And what kind of bond or rapport did you guys or did you guys not establish?
No, he was very good, in fact. I mean, he's very welcoming, very, you know, very good in every way, I would say, except that he was so damn good compared to any other teammate I'd had. It was like literally another world, you know. It was, I'd say I've learned more in that year being his teammate about how to being a professional driver, I guess, you know, than I've learned in my whole career, pretty much. He was just on a whole different level to everybody else.
In
just the way he operated around the car, you know, how he managed the car, the setup, and how, I mean, the first couple of races, I mean, my brain was just fried trying to keep up with the debriefs, you know, and just the amount of information that came out of him. But then I, you know, you sort of learn and you listen and you try to, you know, kind of follow what's going on there. And you could tell it was a certain, you know, he'd broken it down into, you know,
they call him the professor for a reason.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And it's been something that's been helpful ever since. And I'm, well, I know this for a fact that, you know, Senna, before he became Prost's teammate, wasn't even close to the driver he ended up being. Because he'd learned the same process. Because I was teammates with Senna, I remember, in Tolman.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, you have a certain way, method of, let's say, operating around the car and the way you do the debriefs and the setup. And, you know, you talk to your engineers and... But Prost was on a completely different level to all the rest of us, everyone in the field, I would say, without a doubt. Because I knew the other drivers. I mean, I knew Nelson quite well, you know, and Nigel and a lot of the other guys, you know. And he was, well, I mean, it's like almost like, it's interesting because he operated like, I mean, he's the CEO of the car, basically. If you give it an analogy.
That's a great way of putting it.
And he has this whole team of people around him that he just works everybody and try to extract the best out of everybody and, you know, work it so that everybody's working for him. He's the boss of the car and everybody's kind of his team around him, you know. How so it's just like you're the boss of the company and, you know, you direct everybody and, okay, you need to do that, you move you know. It's fantastic, really, you know. It's brilliant.
How would you have described yourself in that analogy then before you came to McLaren?
Well, it was more of a feel thing, you know, just you work more on feel and impulse and just, you know, you try to break down what the car is doing, obviously, but in a different way, you know, not being so much, let's say, in charge of the car. Mm. Like you told them what the car was doing and then you let them basically get on with trying to fix it, you know,
do
it. Yeah, so. But whereas here it was more like, you know, it was a completely integrated in that whole process, you know.
And so this was the MP4-3 chassis that had been fairly well developed, you know, coming in to the 87 season. Power had been pulled back a little bit, but that car, while it never struck me as the best.
Very difficult car to drive. It's probably one of the, Prost would certainly vouch for that too. It's probably, I mean, for him, it was probably the worst car up until then. McLaren, well, because, I mean, before they've always had, you know, winning cars.
Understood.
So it was a very nervous car, you know, very, very, very small window to get into the really good operating window, you know. And very nervous, very, very sensitive car on entry, you know, so it was very difficult to commit, you know, and not over commit. So he's had a very fine balance there of, you know, being in the right space, let's say, either you're not quite pushing quite hard enough, or if you push a little bit harder, you go right over the limit, you know, and then you lose, either you spin or you lose more time trying to catch it, you know. So it was a very tough car to extract the most out of. And then we had a lot of engine issues that year as well. It was last year of the Tag Heuer engine, you know, and it was had a lot of just niggling little mechanical issues, a lot of turbo issues, and just generally, you know, not a very not a lot of continuity, let's say, in the development of that.
Almost like that chassis, that engine, which had again world champion success with Nicky and Alain, seemed like that it was definitely at the end of its development life, if not a little bit past. I mean, we saw the following year in 88 with the MP44, Gordon Murray at his best. But it definitely seemed like they were trying to get one more year out of a car that, you know, maybe, I don't know if it had a year to give.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, it was definitely that sort of that final transition. And I think a lot of the other teams progressed a lot more that year, let's say, you know, and it was difficult, extra difficult for me because I hardly did any testing the whole year. I mean, I did like, I think a total of 30 laps in the car the whole season. Jeez. That was it, yeah. I mean, no, so it was, you know, you arrive at all these tracks and you try to commit in qualifying, and then you have Prost as your teammate on top of it, you know, so I mean, it makes it even more difficult, of course. But so in retrospect, I don't think I did too bad because I think I finished 15 points behind him in the championship.
Yeah. I mean, you.
He was fourth and I was sixth. So.
Lots, you know, almost a handful of podiums as well.
So if you, you know, but of course, you know, sixth doesn't mean anything in the bigger picture. But if you look at it from that point of view, you know, I think I certainly did as well as could be, you know, possible in the circumstances.
And that was our pal Stefan Johansson, part two of the My Racing Life and Career series. So we'll definitely again try and get the other parts up and running here before too long. If you get a chance, would definitely appreciate if you check out our Marshall Pruitt YouTube page, trying to build a subscriber base there. I have some new videos that are going to be going up, some old videos that are going to be going up. Found a whole stash of content I'd forgotten about that I created back at Le Mans in 2008, so 10 years ago. And since I'm going to have to miss this year's event, figure I'll wheel out, freshen up, and then wheel out some of that content from about 10 years ago. But again, if you get a chance, if you happen to be in YouTube land, if you can check out my little page there, the Marshall Pruitt page on YouTube, and subscribe, that would be awesome. All right, time for me to say my name more than once and in a weird way. I'm Marshall Pruitt. This is the Marshall Pruitt Podcast presented by Cooper Tires. Thank you for listening.